Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Today on the program, we will hear from a Native American representative and from the Wyoming Game and Fish Department regarding legislation being considered in Congress that would require tribes to be included in decisions regarding grizzly bear management. We will also revisit a clergy abuse investigation.
The trauma of that means that I just actually do not have that memory.
And we will look at efforts to enhance wind energy in Wyoming.
I think Wyoming, more so than many of the states surrounding it, has not necessarily been a friendly place for wind to be developed.
And learn why lawmakers are bullish about blockchain. Those stories and a StoryCorps from Jackson on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Last week, a bill was introduced in Congress that would require tribes to be included in the management of grizzly bears. The legislation, called the Tribal Heritage and Grizzly Bear Protection Act, would permanently place grizzly bears under federal protection, much like the bald eagle. Two Wyoming Public Radio reporters spoke to opposite camps on the subject. Melody Edwards sat down with Northern Arapaho Standing Rock Lakota member Lynette Grable, who testified in support of the bill and on behalf of the Northern Arapaho Tribal Elder Society.
The Tribal Heritage and Grizzly Bear Act is one of the oldest signed treaties in U.S. history. 1903, I believe, was the date that the Tribal Heritage and Grizzly Bear Protection Act was developed and signed and put into action. And it was to protect our grizzly bears in the whole nation. The numbers was that from the Missouri River all the way down to the California coast, there used to be over 50,000 grizzly bears. And now, if we're just talking about, let's say, the Yellowstone Park, we have 700 grizzly bears presently. And so with those numbers that we compare to what they were before and where they are now, and the other factors of, you know, are they impeding in our communities and et cetera, those types of issues. Is grizzly bear should be something we trophy hunt for. And so, you know, I was honored to be one of the persons and witness to testify to Congress to ensure that we, us as Northern Arapaho and Eastern Shoshone of the Wind River Tribe, that, and I submitted letters, signed letters from both tribes, that these, we support not the grizzly, the Tribal Heritage and Grizzly Bear Protection Act, but we also say that this is not, this is something that is culturally inappropriate for us. The grizzly bear for another Arapaho tribe, the word that we use for grizzly bear is of a relative. And so one of the quotes that I stated in the testimony, which I will state from my uncle Crawford White, who is one of our ceremonial elders, is, you know, the grizzly bear is our relative, so is thought of as a human just like us. They know what our medicines are, which is our cedar, our sage, and so forth. So what next are you going to hunt us? You know, so this is how we look at the grizzly bear according to our culture and our heritage. And, you know, we always have to remind ourselves, like, they're not impeding in our camp. We're in their camp. You know, we're in their habitat. The grizzly bear is reflective to our nation, just like the bald eagle. We would never hunt the bald eagle, so we should never hunt the grizzly bear.
So if this act was passed, how would tribes be more included in the conversation of how to manage grizzly bears?
There were some things proposed to Congress on how tribal nations can manage the grizzly bear. And so there was things proposed for that. At the end of the day, we just don't want the grizzly bear to be hunted as a trophy. The Native American Religious Act that was developed in 1973, that would also impede on that. So there's a lot of different treaties and tribal laws that are there in place that says that we can have our tribal religious freedom. And if this Grizzly Bear Act is not re-implemented, then it would be a whole nother lawsuit. It would be a whole nother, I guess, fight to stand up for.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards speaking with Northern Arapaho Lakota member Lynette Grable. Now we will turn it over to Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska, who spoke with the director of the Wyoming Game and Fish Department, Brian Nesvik. Kudelska asked Nesvik why he believes the act would hurt the grizzly population if passed.
Basically, in perpetuity, the people of the state of Wyoming would not have the opportunity to manage the grizzly bear, a species of wildlife that's fully recovered and doesn't require federal protections anymore. It would not allow Wyoming people to be involved in the management of that species. I think it would have broader implications to other species, because that would be a disincentive to our state to continue to do work to recover other species. If there's no opportunity to ever have them recovered and management returned to the state, and that it's going to continue to always be a federally managed species, you know, there's not a lot of reason for the state of Wyoming to invest time and resources into recovery. And frankly, if the state wouldn't have done that in the case of the grizzly bear, I don't believe they would be recovered.
So that the state wouldn't really want to manage those type of, or help recover endangered species if there's no
opportunity to ever be able
return
to,
back to state.
Yeah, return right. It back to state management. If management of the bear was destined to be by the federal government forever, I can see, you know, a situation where decision makers would decide to turn all the on-the-ground everyday activities, including the handling of conflict, including routine data collection, all those things over to the federal government. And I can see conflicts between bears and humans increasing, and a continual widening of the distribution of grizzly bears out to places where there's not biologically or socially suitable habitats.
How would human and grizzly bear conflicts potentially increase?
Because I don't believe that the federal government has the resources to be able to handle those conflicts now and resolve them nearly to the level that the state does. And we have an entire large carnivore crew that works locally with livestock producers, outfitters, people who recreate in grizzly bear country, people who work in grizzly bear country, people who live in grizzly bear country. We have people that on an everyday basis are dealing with those folks and helping them deal with conflict. And the resources nor the expertise, neither one of those exist in the federal government. And if they were responsible for all that, I don't believe it would happen it wouldn't be as effective.
And then you mentioned distribution shift. It seems that the other side is arguing that they want the grizzly bears to be able to distribute further. So what is your argument of that not being a good thing?
It's not a good thing because the grizzly bears, at least in Wyoming, have saturated the biologically and socially suitable habitat that's available. The places where they're moving to now are not places where grizzly bears can do well. I mean, it's not good when we have grizzly bears in places that on human-dominated landscapes, you know, like moving into cornfields east of Clark, Wyoming. It's not good to have grizzly bears in places where they're not in remote areas, where they're around people all the time, because they just get into trouble and they're a human safety problem. Not good for the bear, and it's not good for people.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska speaking with Brian Nesvik on the Tribal Heritage and Grizzly Bear Protection Act. The legislation is being considered by the U.S. House Natural Resources Subcommittee on Water, Oceans, and Wildlife. When we come back, we will revisit a story we've been following over the past several months. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. 16 years ago, the Cheyenne Police Department received a report that a former Catholic bishop had sexually abused a teenage boy in the 1970s. The lead detective told the prosecutor there was no evidence and the case was closed. Late last year, that case was reopened and multiple victims have since come forward. The second chance at justice reflects how law enforcement attitudes toward sexual abuse are starting to change. Wyoming Public Radio's Tennessee Watson has more.
The 2002 investigation of former Catholic Bishop Joseph Hart didn't lead to prosecution. His innocence or guilt was not determined, but a press release from law enforcement made it sound like they knew for sure Hart had done no wrong. It recommended no further action and the case be closed. Jeff Schulz was the lead detective on the case. He's no longer a police officer and referred me to the Cheyenne PD for comment. The victim says there's lots to learn from what happened in 2002.
The first investigation was so horribly botched.
Marty, the victim, grew up in Cheyenne. After high school, he left Wyoming and never came back. He now runs his own business in New York City. To protect his privacy, I'm using a version of his middle name. Marty says it felt like Detective Jeff Schulz started the investigation with his mind made up.
His opening introduction was, you know, you realize what you're saying is that this pillar of the community is basically a monster and that there's nobody else saying any of this. So why is it that you're coming forward?
Marty says it felt like Schulz didn't want to hear what he had to say.
This is somebody who's cross-examining me or probing in an accusatory way for gaps in my recollection.
During that interview, Marty told Schulz that when he was 12 years old, his dad took off. His mom was left alone with four kids to support. Seeing a family in need, the Catholic diocese gave his mom a job. Marty and his siblings went to Catholic school for free. Marty kept quiet when the abuse started because he didn't want to put his family in jeopardy. When Schulz asked what month his dad left, Marty felt nervous and embarrassed because he couldn't remember.
To be critiqued during this line of questioning for those failures, it really shattered my confidence in what I was saying.
So he stopped taking calls from Schulz and let the idea of holding Joseph Hart accountable drift away. Fast forward 16 years to a moment when both clergy and cops are under scrutiny for sweeping sexual abuse under the rug. To help right those wrongs, Catholic leaders in Wyoming urged the Cheyenne PD to take a second look at Marty's case. The department reopened the case this summer. Marty vividly remembers his first conversation with Sergeant Joel Hickerson.
I was very blunt in my recounting the failures of the past and telling him that I did not have any expectation that his investigation was going to go much better. And his response was remarkable. And he said, well, the Cheyenne Police Department has come a long way.
Hickerson has been with the Cheyenne PD for 11 years. He started on patrol and is now the head detective for persons crimes.
Historically, throughout America, we had issues where not believing our victims and victim blaming was part and parcel to our belief system or our views. Over the last 10 to 15 years, that's really changed on a national level, and Cheyenne has followed that.
This new approach to policing focuses on one central concept. Officers need to start by believing victims.
If they were anxious and worried that they've got a cynical jerk officer, it's going to create issues. If that individual is a victim is under stress and they're feeling judged, either they're going to close down or they're going to be so stressed out about that contact, they're going to forget those details.
Hickerson says when officers are open and listen, they gather stronger evidence. But sometimes there are details victims just can't recall.
And we need to understand that the mind, especially in times of trauma, basically takes snapshots of situations.
It's a coping mechanism, Hickerson says. We can only handle so many vivid, painful memories. For example, Marty remembers the details of the abuse, but he can't remember the exact month his dad abandoned the family.
Because I was a 12-year-old, and the trauma of that means that I just actually do not have that memory.
But it's a detail that's important to the investigation. It helps establish a timeline and explains how his family's reliance on the Catholic Church made him vulnerable to abuse. Marty says this time, instead of facing skepticism, the Cheyenne PD is working with him to put the pieces together.
The detective told me he was going to get records from the military to find out information about my father that I didn't know. So the scope of what he was telling me he was going to do was shocking, actually. I mean, it was really thorough.
Tara Muir is the policy director for the Cheyenne Coalition Against Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. She applauds the efforts of the Cheyenne PD to seek out training and follow best practices.
It'd be great to have it implemented statewide within Wyoming.
Right now, it's up to each agency to prioritize sexual violence training. Muir says it's hit or miss whether that happens. That means Marty's experience in 2002 is still a possibility.
Which is heartbreaking because it does feel like a crapshoot for victims.
In a future story, I'll take a closer look at gaps in sexual violence training and efforts to get more officers to start by believing. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Tennessee Watson.
Changing gears, we've obviously been following the trends in coal, oil, and gas in recent months, but seven states have wind energy projects underway that will double their capacities, the total amount of electricity that could be generated by wind, and Wyoming is among them. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim reports the surge comes after a decade of almost no growth in the state.
On a vast swath of prairie lined with 79 wind turbines, new blades are being delivered on the backs of 18-wheelers. Lane Anderson navigates the snow-packed service roads. He oversees all wind operations at Rocky Mountain Power, part of PacifiCorp. He parks under a massive turbine.
We're at 7 mile 409. This is our first test turbine for repowering.
This whole wind farm will be repowered, where new equipment allows the same turbines to produce more energy. New cells, hubs, and blades lying around the site will soon increase production by 20%. It's not the company's only project, either. Rocky Mountain Power is developing four new wind farms in Wyoming to be finished by 2021. Anderson points out one new site in the distance. It takes a second to make out the white sticks.
Our Dunlap wind site is over there in the distance. Over there at Dunlap, TB1 and TB2 will be on the north and south side of that wind plant, and Ecola will be right in between these.
With these four projects, plus three more from other entities, they will add more than double the state's existing wind energy capacity. Six other states are also on pace to double capacity, including Arkansas, New Mexico, and Maryland. That's according to the American Wind Energy Association. This is just the latest push of what's been an upward trend in the past few decades for wind. In 2009, wind was less than 1% of total generation across the U.S. Now, it's five times that. Robert McCullough leads an energy consulting firm. He says the reason for all this growth is low costs.
It's much easier to buy power on the open market than maintain an elderly coal unit. We're seeing that all over the United States.
A report from Lazard, a financial advisory firm, shows the cost of producing wind has gone down by nearly 70% in 9 years, sitting at prices dramatically below coal. Low prices are pushed even lower thanks to a federal tax credit that's set to end by 2020. Uday Varavadajan is a principal at Rocky Mountain Institute, a nonprofit focused on clean energy.
There are a lot of other states that are trying to figure out a way to put as much wind in the ground as they can.
With more and more demand from states with renewable standards and declining costs, he says it's hard for states like Wyoming to avoid new projects.
The question is, do you want to take that opportunity or not? And if you don't, it's getting harder and harder to say that you don't want to take that money from the people who want to buy your wind.
Wyoming hasn't been eager to embrace wind. If you live here, you know it's windy. The state has the seventh highest wind capacity potential, but it sits at 15th in installed capacity, according to the Department of Energy. And until this surge, growth has been stagnant. One wind developer says it's not easy to do business in the state. Paul Martin of Intermountain Wind says that's due to lack of transmission, public opposition, long permitting times, and a tax on wind, which only one other state has. Varavadajan explains the challenge.
I think Wyoming, more so than many of the states surrounding it, has not necessarily been a friendly place for wind to be developed.
Gillette Senator Michael Von Fladern says he has seen a lack of support at the state level. That's because it's felt like wind energy is supplanting other state industries, like coal. But with such good prices and coal on the decline, legislators have to figure it out.
You know, our customers demand it. We got to comply in some manner. We can't stick our head in the sand and try to say you'll take coal or you'll take nothing.
With less money coming from coal revenues, a group of legislators is motivated to pull more income out of wind. Lander Senator Cale Case is one of them.
We need to have a tax structure that matches the extreme long-term impacts on our view sheds and the environment, the wildlife, everything.
Impacts like noise pollution, interrupting the view, and threats to birds and bats. Case says now is the time to raise Wyoming's wind tax. Instead of $1 per megawatt hour, $5. He says some legislators support it to improve regulation, while others do it because they just don't like wind. That's not him. Back at the Seven Mile Hill Wind Farm, Lane Anderson and Rocky Mountain Power do see Wyoming as a home to world-class wind, and that's not going away.
I believe the renewable resources will be moving into Wyoming a little more readily in the years to come.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Cooper McKim.
Coming up, we will look at a couple of interesting trends in Cody and in Rawlins. This is Open Spaces. This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Wyoming's population declined last year, while the surrounding state's populations grew. But Cody is an outlier of sorts. In the past decade, there's been an influx of people aged 24 to 34 into Park County. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska reports a portion of these are women, providing a steady income and benefits for their families.
A lot of us are here because of the place. Mm-hmm. The career came second or was an addition or a frosting on top.
That's Amy Quick. She and a couple of other women are sitting around chatting about the dynamic of their relationships. Quick came to Cody for a job at the Shoshone National Forest.
I realized pretty early on that I had the where figured out in life. I knew I wanted to stay here. I just didn't. Took a little bit longer to figure out the other questions.
She eventually met her husband, Andy, who owns a small outdoor recreation store in Cody. The business was his passion, and Amy didn't want him to give it up for the sake of their new family.
I don't think it was a conscious decision that I was going to make the benefits. It was just Andy had a kind of a passion for this outdoor recreation business, and it worked out.
Amy found a steady job, and Andy kept his seasonal one running the store. This is not uncommon in Cody. David Bullard is a state economist. He says there are a lot of seasonal jobs in this area.
Yellowstone and Grand Teton Park open for the summer, and so there's a huge amount of seasonal employment there.
Cody has bigger seasonal employment swings than other non-metro Wyoming communities, mainly because it doesn't have a winter economy. So during the winter, Andy works on the business, but also picks up other seasonal jobs like carpentry. The Quicks aren't the only one in this position in Cody. When looking at the numbers, more women are in the labor force in Cody than men, and the industries in which women dominate, like healthcare or education, provide better dependent health insurance. Bullard says that's valuable.
Education and the health care really offer a lot of benefits. Some of the seasonal ones like construction and leisure and hospitality tend to offer a lot less.
So for Elizabeth and Carl Hansen, it also made sense for her to provide the steady income and benefits for the family. Carl works a few different jobs and says Elizabeth's job as a teacher gives him freedom.
There's not a lot of health care packages for cabinet makers and carpenters, so or people that work with horses. It's unusual.
And Elizabeth loves teaching. So in her eyes, it's a win-win.
I love school, and I kept going back to school, and now I spend every day at school.
According to Ben Winchester, a rural sociologist for the University of Minnesota, there has been a trend nationally for people in their 30s to move to rural areas.
Quality of life trumps everything here. It trumps a job. Primarily, people are pulled toward a life that they have more control over.
Back at the gathering, the women say they love their jobs and are doubly grateful that those jobs allow their husbands to do what they are passionate about. And Elizabeth says Wyoming, and especially Cody, attracts people with independent spirits and a frontier mentality.
We do have a lot of people in these roles where women have steady jobs and benefits, and men kind of have a mix of things that keep them going.
In the end, it always comes back to their choice to live near the mountains by any means possible.
It's too hard all around.
Yeah. And that builds the common bond, right?
And yet we like it.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Kadalska at the Center of the West in Cody.
It is painful to watch the small town you love shrink as the young people move to bigger cities in search of jobs and a more urban lifestyle. But in Wyoming and around the West, some towns that would be shuttering are actually starting to see a resurgence of young families moving in, young Latino families. As Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards reports, that kind of growth is really happening in Rawlins.
Rawlins City Councilor and former Mayor Debari Martinez gives me a tour around town in his truck. He points out all the Latino-owned businesses we pass. A flower shop, a photographer's studio, a steakhouse.
They're closed today, but he's a Latino. That's a detail shop. This guy here, his name's Lujan.
Debari says Rawlins has about 17 Latino-owned businesses now and more to come. He says it's nothing new, though. He sits on the local museum board and says Latinos homesteaded here at the same time that whites did.
They started out with the lumber industry, and when it fell apart, they ended up in the sheep industry.
After sheep, jobs opened up in the railroad, the penitentiary, and at the Sinclair Refinery. That's where Debari spent 40 years of his career. Now the refinery is expanding and recently hired hundreds more workers. He says Latinos are more willing to take such jobs than white workers and more willing to stay.
They're going to make their home here. The wages, you wouldn't believe it. I mean, if you got out of high school, you can make $90,000 in a year.
Those kinds of living wages have prompted a growth spurt in minority populations in rural towns across the West, and especially in Wyoming. That's according to a new study by Headwaters Economics, a research firm that studies community development issues.
So because of people of color moving into a community, these places are kind of in some ways being kept afloat.
Economist Megan Lawson says six counties in Wyoming would have lost total population if it wasn't for minority groups settling there. In Rawlins, a quarter of the population is from a minority group. And in Carbon County, where Rawlins sits, it's even more, almost a third of the population. Small towns in Wyoming's eastern and northern plains are also seeing the same population bump because white workers have vacated many farming jobs in those regions.
You know, the challenge of dryland farming in the High Plains, kind of those boom-bust agricultural cycles.
In small towns around the West, minorities clean hotel rooms, build new homes, and serve as nurses to tend the elderly who've been left behind.
Folks moving in are keeping schools open, they're keeping grocery stores, you know, solvent, and those kinds of day-to-day things that really sustain a place.
Josh Martinez is the assistant director of the Rawlins Chamber of Commerce, and his family came here for the railroad and the sheep in the 1890s. He says he remembers how divided the town used to be.
It's kind of the way it was growing up, though, is the south side of Rawlins was the Mexican side.
But Josh grew up on the north side, a sign of how integrated the community has become. He says that, coupled with Rawlins' rich Latino history, has made it more welcoming for families arriving from Texas and Mexico. But he says they also moved to Rawlins for the same reason anyone might, for the wide open spaces.
Us as a culture, you know, we're a very outdoorsy type of group, and it's very natural for us to want to be around nature.
My kids love it. We go out and camp, fishing. Yeah. You know, we spend the weekend there. We have fun. We go out and hang out with friends. It's amazing.
That's entrepreneur Katrina Molina, who just opened an interior decorating store in downtown Rawlins.
Flooring and cabinets. That's what we do.
Molina grew up in Mexico and moved to Denver when she was 16.
It was kind of scary, kind of emotional, because you have to give up your other citizenship.
Her husband found work in Rawlins building homes about 10 years ago, and then recently they bought the interior decorating business.
It just fits. So yeah. We decide to buy it and give it a try.
And how's it been going?
It's been going really, really good.
So good, in fact, that they bought a house in Sinclair, then another in Rawlins that they're remodeling. She says she feels comfortable raising her kids in Rawlins because there's lots of people who share their language and culture. But she says lately a few of those friends have been moving back to Mexico.
I know some people that left, actually, when the president was elected because they were afraid of what was going to happen. So people are scared. They are.
At the end of our tour, City Councilor Debari Martinez drives to the city park and climbs out. He says he's worried that the recent rise in anti-immigrant sentiment in the country could slow down his town's growth. So he decided to get proactive. This year, he threw a Latino festival here with food trucks, a live band.
It was full. It was all the way back there, and there was people yelling and screaming. The hard part was trying to dance.
Debari says he plans to host a Latino festival in Rawlins every year from now on. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Melody Edwards.
When StoryCorps came to Jackson last summer, friends Arnie Jorgensen and Ann Cresswell discussed the lack of concern for affordable housing in their community.
I think people are across the board really passionate about this place, about the scenic beauty, about the natural beauty, about the wildlife, and yet it seems to fall short of extending to the human community that we have here on balance. It doesn't come close to the same kind of support that we have across the board for the physical beauty of this place. Do you have any wisdom to share why we're falling short in that regard?
So at one hand, the conservation ethic, the conservation legacy that you're laying out in the lead up to that question is real, but it also was not easy. So recognizing where we are as a human community within this incredible place, I see as an evolution. If we turn the clock back to the mid-1900s on the conservation side of that equation, there was no certainty of where we're going. There was intense, intense conflict. There is a great photo of our at that time county commissioner, then to be governor of Wyoming, and then Senator Hansen, and a group of horsemen at the Grove, I think at the Grovon Junction, armed and going up to Moose to tell the feds a few things or two because they didn't like what was going on. Mm-hmm. It was a bit of a photo op and they were making a point. But the point is there was a lot of conflict. Mm-hmm. This community did not recognize across the board the importance of that conservation ethic that was playing out. In the 90s, Senator Hansen said, I was wrong. Mm-hmm. No, that was the right thing. The community is better today because of that. So when we look at the discussions we're having today relative to what does it mean to be a community, a human community within this special place, I don't see us being that different than where we were with the conservation ethic. Mm-hmm. So to me, I'm hopeful. I have to be hopeful and saying that we'll get there. But recognizing that we're in, I think, in the middle of that discussion. I feel strongly that the conservation and preservation of this place is made stronger if there is a community of people that live here. In other words, it's not just an economically driven engine. If no one lives here, if we are just that resort, then the only local voice is all driven from money. It's all driven from economics, and there's no human component to that. And I don't think that's as strong of a voice. You're smiling at me a bit.
No, well, it's people that are fighting for and advocating and standing up for this place in the end, after all.
Yeah. Whether we preserve the human part of this community, the people part of this community, that we're really at a tipping point, and I want to be part of those discussions. I'm not willing to accept the resort only.
That's Arnie Jorgensen and Ann Cresswell talking at StoryCorps in Jackson. The piece was produced by Alex Schaefer. We will wrap up the program with stories on citizen moose research and blockchain. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. In wide open spaces like the rural parts of the Mountain West, there's sometimes little known about the secret lives of plants and animals. There are too many square miles and too few scientists. That's where citizen scientists can come to the rescue. Wyoming Public Radio's Mackie Mullen checked out their role in surveying moose in one corner of Wyoming.
If you've ever looked around the place where you live and made some kind of observation about the natural world, then you're well on your way to becoming a citizen scientist.
Citizen science is when scientists enlist volunteers to help conduct scientific research.
That's Zoe Nelson. She works at the Barry Biodiversity Institute on the University of Wyoming's campus. The institute runs citizen science projects all over the state. Here's how it works.
Scientists ask a question, design a protocol, and then we work with them to help recruit volunteers, retain volunteers, and answer that question through collecting field data.
Which brings us to the moose survey. Wyoming's Game and Fish Department has a job for some citizen scientists and wants to know more about the animal in the Snowy Mountain Range in southeastern Wyoming. But before volunteers are sent out into the field, they need to know what to look for. Alex May is a graduate student in zoology and physiology and gave the training this year. For starters, it included where to look.
In this area, they're really closely tied to river corridors and aspen stands. So if you're going up in the mountains, you know, trying to stay near streams or rivers is a really good first step.
And if a citizen scientist spots a moose on their route, May says there are particular data points they're supposed to collect.
Where they see the moose, what the sex is, so is it a male or female, approximate age, and then whether there's a calf or two even with the female.
The bulk of the training is being able to get an idea for those things just by looking at the moose. For example, adult females will have a white blaze mark on their rump, and males will have antlers or exposed bone of the skull depending on the time of year. May says it's also important to look for signs of things that may be hurting the moose population.
The arterial worm and the winter tick are two parasites that moose can have that you can sometimes see evidence of.
Like ears that look as if they've been snipped off on top, or big patches of bare skin and hair that has turned white. If a citizen scientist doesn't see any moose on Moose Day, that's just as important. Zoe Nelson says no data is still data.
Zero is a number in science, and I think that that is also a really cool kind of statement to help hopefully draw deeper connections into the scientific process.
Zero is a number citizen scientist Kin Zajac and his hiking buddy Bob Kubicek are familiar with. I've met up with them for their ninth Moose Day.
Did you mention to Maggie that we've been doing this for however many years and we've never seen a moose yet?
We're in Kubicek's truck, headed to Vitavu, an area of rocky outcrops within the Medicine Bow Route National Forest. It's about 20 miles outside of Laramie. Soon after we hit a gravel road, we come to a gate meant to stop vehicles.
The seasonal closure. Stop here and walk.
Yep, that's it.
The 5-mile route we'll hike today has been predetermined by the Wyoming Game and Fish Department. It selects about 30 different routes in southeastern Wyoming twice a year for Moose Day. Then, volunteers sign up for the route of their choosing to hike on a date that is also predetermined. Kubicek says they got involved with Moose Day back when it started in 2015.
That was the first I'd ever heard of the whole citizen science idea.
His buddy, Kin Zajac, says it's also a good excuse to get outside.
Especially out here in Wyoming. We got some of the last good stuff left.
We've made it to the part of the route that's surrounded by willows. Kubicek says that's prime moose habitat.
So pretty deluxe place to eat, you know, buffet.
Soon we come around a bend and stop right in our tracks. We stay as quiet as we can because just to the left of the trail, about 30 yards away, we've spotted a moose. It's pretty big and it doesn't have a white patch on its rump, so we guess that it's an adult male. We stand there for a while, the moose looking at us looking at him, then it disappears back into the trees.
Well, finally.
Yes.
Always great to see a moose, always.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Maggie Mullen.
While the Wyoming legislature was busy fighting about private schools, the budget, and a few tax issues last session, it also passed legislation that continues to make the state the place to be for blockchain technology. While it didn't get a lot of attention in Wyoming, those new laws are getting worldwide attention. Blockchain is a digital ledger that can be accessed instantly. It's most commonly used in the financial world, where digital money can be transferred back and forth without delay. But blockchain can be used for other things as well. We'll get to that later. This session, the legislature passed a law making Wyoming the first state to recognize cryptocurrencies as money, and also allow depositories, which are like banks, to come to the state and store the digital assets. Caitlin Long is a Wyoming native with a long history on Wall Street and is the co-chair of the Wyoming Blockchain Coalition.
This was one where being first actually really does matter because we could grab a first mover advantage, and it's pretty clearly starting to play out that way.
Long says it's hard to overstate the interest in what Wyoming is doing.
I've had thousands of inquiries personally through social media just in the past 2 weeks. And when I published a piece on Forbes.com 2 days ago that summarizes the importance of the legislation, within 24 hours, it had 22,000 views.
That's not a surprise to Laramie Senator Chris Rothfuss, who says the worldwide interest has been high ever since Wyoming embarked on this effort.
Of all the years that I've been on the legislature, this is the first time that I've been in a committee where people fly from all over the world to participate, where we have billionaires sitting in the back of the room to provide testimony on what it is that we're working on, where we receive unsolicited advice from law firms on the East Coast that work in securities.
Recognizing digital assets was huge for Wyoming, but he says the so-called digital banks bill was equally big. That's because specialized banks are needed to store digital money.
That allows these innovative and kind of advanced startups to be able to bank and pay their paycheck.
Already several of these repositories are looking to set up shop in Wyoming. Sheridan Representative Cyrus Western says the need is great.
Goldman Sachs issued a white paper back last summer that said, you know, there's about $110 trillion worth of securities floating around on the global market, of which they think in the next 5 years, 5 or so years, 10% of that's going to be shift or migrate towards blockchain. So we're talking well over $10 trillion is going to be need to store it somewhere.
Western says the main exchange in the digital currency world is paying close attention.
The founder and CEO of Kraken, which is one of the big Bitcoin exchanges, I think they've got like 6 or 7 million users. You know, they were here because they were extremely interested and are strongly considering moving their operations to Wyoming. And I think this is a company with like 700 employees. When you get people like that knocking on your door, something's going right.
Sundance representative Tyler Lindholm says helping legislators understand the importance of this has taken some time and education, but he says businesses get it.
We had a business last year that got a hold of us after our first round of legislation and let us know that their headquarters were officially moving from New York City to Jackson. I don't know that that's ever happened.
Lindholm says the blockchain opportunities are not limited to finance either. Wyoming has developed BeefChain, where Wyoming cattle and beef products can be tracked globally. He notes that Walmart used blockchain during the romaine lettuce scare. At first, it took 7 days to figure out where the produce came from. But after developing a blockchain technology, the information is available immediately.
So 2.2 seconds are able to trace directly back to where that food comes from. So on a foodborne illness aspect, the technology is wonderful. On a regulatory aspect, as good as it can be.
Rothfuss says entrepreneurs are flowing into the state, developing all kinds of technologies.
We are already seeing innovative technologies being explored in the state of Wyoming and effectively beta testing them here so that they can then develop a product to the rest of the country.
Rothfuss adds this is happening with little spending from the state.
The blockchain task force work has probably accomplished more to diversify the economy of Wyoming than the Endow Initiative.
Rothfuss and others are now going to wait and see what happens. Todd Skinner was a world-renowned rock climber. His climbing achievements included the first three ascents of many routes around the world. 13 years ago, Skinner died in a climbing accident on El Capitan. When StoryCorps came to Jackson last summer, Maddie Schaefer sat down with Todd's widow, Amy Skinner, to discuss his death and why they keep rock climbing.
I was just talking to my friend. Her nephew had been involved in a climbing accident on El Cap. And he survived, but the two other men in the party did not. And so she was reaching out to me asking how you go forward. She asked that classic question, like, why do you keep doing it? Or
why do you keep climbing?
Yeah.
Yeah, why climbing at all? And why continue? I think it's human nature to want to explore your own boundaries and know who you are better. And so climbing for me has been a vehicle for that, not only to have found my closest friendships and most meaningful, longest-lasting friendship, but also to bump up against fear. Because fear has always been something that I've felt in my life since I was a little girl. And when I go climbing, I have to confront it, or it's paralyzing. So I have to listen to it. I have to identify if it's valid, if it can inform me. I've spent some years early in my climbing career trying to push it away and just be fearless, but that wasn't working. And it took me a while to realize that it just wasn't an authentic solution. What I needed to do was realize I had a lot of fear and I needed to hear what it had to tell me and go through that like a checklist. So for me, I think it's given me wings in other parts of my life that I would be too locked up and afraid if I hadn't learned how to handle fear.
I remember not wanting to climb for a little while after Todd died. I was so scared. I didn't climb. I didn't fly the airplane. It just sat in the hangar. I realized that I was a single parent, and I was scared for a while.
Yeah. I remember you being so scared. I remember coming over to Lander and saying, well, let's just go for a walk, because you didn't want to go climb. But I talked you into walking up to the crag to belaying me. And then you took shoes, and I would say, why don't you just take a lap? And you'd say, well, okay. And then I could see your body love it. I could just see you were, like, back to what you knew and loved and laughing and, you know, having snacks and just letting it be what it was without pressure. And then I remember you just got after it more and more. That was such strong work.
It was really basic stuff that I thought, I can stay home and be afraid, or I can go do what I love to do with the people I want to be with. That was the big thing for me.
Yeah.
I think when I did start climbing again, it felt like I was home.
That's Amy Skinner and Maddie Schaefer talking at StoryCorps in Jackson. This piece was produced by Alex Schaefer. Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. Please support award-winning and in-depth Wyoming and regional news coverage with your pledge of support at wyomingpublicmedia.org. We always invite you to send us your story or interview ideas, and we invite you to never miss an episode by signing up for our podcast, either through our website or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks to our web editor, Anna Rader, for a job well done. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.